This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Girl in the Spider's Web by David Lagercrantz. Translated from the Swedish by George Goulding. Read for you by Simon Vance. Prologue. 1 year earlier. This story begins with a dream, and not a particularly spectacular one at that. Just a hand beating rhythmically and relentlessly on a mattress in a room on Lundegarten. Yet it still gets Lisbeth Salander out of her bed in the early light of dawn. Then she sits at her computer and starts the hunt. Part 1. The Watchful Eye. November 1st to 21st. The NSA, or National Security Agency, is a U.S. federal authority that reports to the Department of Defense. The head office is in Fort Meade, Maryland, by the Patuxent Freeway. Since its founding in 1952, the NSA has been engaged in signals surveillance, these days mostly in connection with internet and telephone traffic. Time after time, its powers have been increased, and now it monitors more than 20 billion conversations and messages every 24 hours. Chapter 1. Early November. Franz Balder had always thought of himself as a lousy father. He had hardly attempted to shoulder the role of father before, and he did not feel comfortable with the task now that his son was 8. But it was his duty. That is how he saw it. The boy was having a rough time living with Balder's ex-wife and her obnoxious partner, Lasse Westman. So Balder had given up his job in Silicon Valley, gotten on a plane home to Sweden, and was now standing at Arlanda Airport, almost in shock, waiting for a taxi. The weather was hellish. Rain whipped onto his face, and for the 100th time he wondered if he was doing the right thing. That he, of all self-centered idiots, should become a full-time father. How crazy an idea was that? He might as well have gotten a job at the zoo. He knew nothing about children, and not much about life in general. The strangest thing of all was nobody had asked him to do it. No mother or grandmother had called him, pleading and telling him to face up to his responsibilities. It was his own decision. He was proposing to defy a long-standing custody ruling and, without warning, walk into his ex-wife's place and bring home his boy, August. No doubt all hell would break loose. That damn Lasse Westman would probably give him a real beating. But he put that out of his mind, and got into a taxi with a woman driver who was dementedly chewing gum and at the same time trying to strike up a conversation with him. She would not have succeeded even on one of his better days. Balder was not one for small talk. He sat there in the back seat, thinking about his son and everything that had happened recently. August was not the only, or even the main reason why he had stopped working at Solifon. His life was in turmoil, and for a moment he wondered if he really knew what he was getting himself into. As the taxi came into the Vasastan neighborhood, Balder felt as if all the blood was draining from his body. But there was no turning back now. He paid the taxi on Torsgarten and took out his luggage, leaving it just inside the building's front entrance. The only thing he took with him up the stairs was an empty suitcase covered with a brightly coloured map of the world, which he had bought at San Francisco International. He stood outside the apartment door, panting. With his eyes closed, he imagined all the possible scenarios of fighting and screaming, and actually, he thought, you could hardly blame them. Nobody just turns up and snatches a child from his home, least of all a father whose only previous involvement had consisted of depositing money into a bank account. But this was an emergency, so he steeled himself and rang the doorbell, resisting the urge to run away. At first there was no answer. Then the door flew open, and there was Westman, with his piercing blue eyes and massive chest and enormous fists. He seemed built to hurt people, which was why he so often got to play the bad guy on screen, even if none of the roles he played, Balder was convinced of this, were as evil as the person he was in real life.
"Christ," Westman said, "look what we have here.
The genius himself has come to visit.
I'm here to fetch August, Balder said.
You what?
I'm taking him away with me, lassie.
You must be joking.
I've never been more serious, he tried.
And then Hannah appeared from a room across to the left. True, she was not as beautiful as she had once been. There had been too much unhappiness for that, and probably too many cigarettes and too much drink as well. But still he felt an unexpected wave of affection, especially when he noticed a bruise on her throat. She seemed to want to say something welcoming, even under the circumstances, but she never had time to open her mouth.
"Why should you care all of a sudden?"
Vestman said.
"Because August has been through enough. He needs a stable home."
"And you think you can provide that, you freak? Since when have you done anything except stare at a computer screen?"
"I've changed," he said,
feeling pathetic, in part because he doubted that he had changed one little bit. A shiver ran through Balder as Westman came towards him with his mighty bulk and his pent-up rage. It became crushingly clear that he would have no means of resistance if that madman let fly. The whole idea had been insane from the start, but surprisingly there was no outburst, no scene, just a grim smile, and then the words,
"Well, isn't that just great?"
"What do you mean?" Hannah asked.
"That it's about time, isn't it, Hannah? Finally some sense of responsibility from Mr. High and Mighty. Bravo! Bravo!"
Vestman clapped his hands theatrically. Afterwards, that was what Balder found most frightening. How easily they let the boy go. Perhaps they saw August only as a burden. It was hard to tell. Hannah shot Balder some glances which were difficult to read, and her hands shook and her jaw was clenched. But she asked too few questions. She should really have been cross-examining him, making thousands of demands, warning him and worrying that the boy's routine would be upset. But all she said was,
"Are you sure about this? Will you manage?"
"I'm sure," he said.
Then they went to August's room. Balder had not seen him for more than a year, and he felt ashamed. How could he have abandoned such a boy? He was so beautiful and strangely wonderful with his curly, bushy hair and slender body and serious blue eyes, engrossed in a gigantic jigsaw puzzle of a sailboat. His body seemed to cry out, "Don't disturb me," and Balder walked up to him slowly, as if approaching an exotic creature. He nonetheless managed to get the boy to take hold of his hand and follow him out into the corridor. He would never forget it. What was August thinking? What did he imagine was happening? He neither looked up at him nor at his mother, and of course he ignored all the waving and the words of farewell. He just vanished into the lift with Balder. It was as simple as that. August was autistic. He was most likely also mentally disabled, even though they had not received unequivocal advice on that point, and anyone who saw him from afar might suspect the opposite. His exquisite face radiated an air of majestic detachment, or at least suggested that he did not think it worth bothering with his surroundings. But when you looked at him closely, there was something impenetrable in his gaze. He had yet to say his first word. In this, he had failed to live up to all the prognoses made when he was 2 years old. At the time, the doctors had said that August probably belonged to that minority of autistic children who had no learning impairment, and that, provided he was given intensive behavioural therapy, his prospects were quite good. But nothing had turned out as they had hoped, and Balder had no idea what had become of all that remedial care and assistance, or even the boy's schooling. Balder had run away to the United States and lived in his own world. He had been a fool, but now he was going to repay his debt and take care of his son. Right away, he ordered casebooks and called specialists and educational experts, and it became immediately apparent that none of the money he had been sending had gone towards August's care, but instead had trickled out to pay for other things, probably Vestman's extravagances and gambling debts. The boy seemed to have been left pretty much to his own devices, allowed to become set in his compulsive ways, and probably worse. This was also the reason why Franz had come home. A psychologist had called to express concern about unexplained bruises covering August's arms and legs, chest and shoulders. According to Hannah, they were because the boy had fits and hurt himself thrashing back and forth. Balder had witnessed one already on the second day, and it scared him out of his wits. But that could not account for the sheer number and type of bruises, he thought. He suspected violence, and turned for help to a GP and a former policeman whom he knew privately. Even if they were not able to confirm his fears with any degree of certainty, he grew more and more angry about it, and set about submitting a series of formal letters and reports. He almost forgot all about the boy. It was easy to forget him. August spent most of his time sitting on the floor in the room Balder had prepared for him in the house in Saltschubaden, doing his exceedingly difficult jigsaws, assembling hundreds of pieces only to break them up and start afresh. At first, Balder had observed him in fascination. It was like watching a great artist at work, and sometimes he was taken by the fantasy that the boy would glance up at any moment and say something grown up. But August never uttered a word. If he raised his head from the puzzle, it was to look straight past him, towards the window, overlooking the sea and the sunshine reflected on the water, and eventually Balder just left him alone. Balder seldom even took him outside into the garden. From a legal point of view, he did not have custody of the boy, and he did not want to take any chances until he had sorted this out. So he let the housekeeper, Lottie Rask, do all the shopping, and all the cooking and cleaning. Balder was no good at that side of things. He understood computers and algorithms, but not much else, and he immersed himself in them even more. At night he slept as badly as he had in California. Lawsuits and storms loomed on the horizon, and every evening he drank a bottle of red wine, usually Amarone, and that probably did little good either, except in the short term. He began to feel worse and worse, and fantasized about vanishing in a puff of smoke, or taking himself off to some inhospitable place somewhere remote. But then, one Saturday in November, something happened. It was a cold, windy evening, and he and August were walking along Ringvägen in the Södermalm district, feeling frozen. They had been having dinner at Farah Sharif's on Zinkensweg. August should have long since been asleep, but dinner had gone on late, and Balder had revealed far too much. Farah Sharif tended to have that effect on people. She and Balder had known each other since they had read computer sciences at Imperial College in London, and now Sharif was one of the few people at his level in Sweden, or at least one of the few who was by and large able to follow his thinking. It was an incredible relief for him to meet someone who could understand. He also found her attractive, but despite numerous attempts he had never managed to seduce her. Balder was not much good at seducing women. But this time he had received a farewell hug that almost turned into a kiss, which was a big step forward. He was still thinking about it as he and August passed Zinkensdamm Sports Center. Maybe next time he should get a babysitter. And then perhaps, who knows? A dog was barking some ways off, and there was a woman's voice shouting behind him, but it was hard to tell if she was upset or happy. He looked over towards Hornsgarten and the intersection where he could pick up a taxi or take the Tunnelbana down to Slussen. It felt like it might rain. Once they got to the crossing, the light turned to red, and on the other side of the street stood a worn-looking man in his 40s who seemed vaguely familiar. At precisely that moment, Balder took hold of August's hand. He only wanted to make sure his son stayed on the sidewalk, but then he felt it. August's hand tensed, as if the boy were reacting strongly to something. His look was intense and clear, as though the veil which always seemed to cover his eyes had been magically drawn aside, and instead of staring inwards at his own complexities, August had apparently understood something uniquely deep and great about that intersection. So Balder ignored the fact that the light had turned green. He just let his son stand there and observe the scene. And without knowing why, he was overcome by a strong emotion, which he found strange. It was only a look, after all, and not even an especially bright or joyful one at that. Yet it rang a distant bell, stirred something long dormant in his memory. For the first time in an age, he felt hopeful. Chapter 2 November 20th Mikael Blomkvist had slept for only a few hours, because he had stayed up, reading a detective novel by Elizabeth George. Not a particularly sensible thing to do. Ove Levin, the newspaper guru from Cerner Media, was due to present a strategy session for Millennium magazine later that morning, and Blomkvist ought to be rested and ready for combat. But he had no desire to be sensible. Only reluctantly did he get up and make himself an unusually strong cappuccino with his Dura Impressa X7, a machine which had been delivered to his home a while ago with a note saying, "According to you, I don't know how to use it anyway." It now stood there in the kitchen like a memorial to a better time. He no longer had any contact with the person who had sent it, nor did he feel that his work was particularly stimulating these days. Over the weekend he had even considered looking around for something new, and that was a pretty drastic idea for a man like Mikael Blomkvist. Millennium had been his passion and his life, and many of his life's best, most dramatic events had occurred in connection with the magazine. But nothing lasts forever, perhaps not even a love for Millennium. Besides, this was not a good time to own a magazine dedicated to investigative journalism. All publications with ambitions for greatness were bleeding to death, and he could not help but reflect that while his own vision for Millennium may have been beautiful and true on some higher plane, it would not necessarily help the magazine survive. He went into the living room, sipping his coffee, and looked out at the waters of Riddarfjärden. There was quite a storm blowing out there. From an Indian summer which had kept the city's outdoor restaurants and cafes open well into October, the weather had turned nightmarish, with gusts of wind and cloudbursts, and people hurried bent double through the streets. Blomkvist had stayed in all weekend, not only because of the weather. He had been planning revenge on an ambitious scale. But the scheme had come to nothing, and that was not like him, neither the former nor the latter. He was not an underdog, and unlike so many other big media figures in Sweden, he did not suffer from an inflated ego which needed constant boosting and soothing. On the other hand, he had been through a few tough years. Barely a month ago, the financial journalist William Borey had written a piece in Cerner's Business Life magazine under the heading, "Mikael Blomkvist's Days Are Over." The fact that the article had been written in the first place, and been given such prominence, was of course a sign that Blomkvist's position was still strong. No one would say that the column was well written or original, and it should have been easy to dismiss as yet another attack from a jealous colleague. But for some reason, incomprehensible in retrospect, the whole thing blew up. At first it might have been interpreted as a spirited discussion about journalism, but gradually the debate began to go off the rails. Although the serious press stayed out of it, all kinds of invective were being spewed out in social media. The offence came not only from financial journalists and industry types, who had reason to set upon their enemy now that he was temporarily weakened, but also from a number of younger writers who took the opportunity to make a name for themselves. They pointed out that Blomkvist was not on Twitter or Facebook, and should rather be seen as a relic of a bygone age, in which people could afford to work their way through whichever strange old volumes happened to take their fancy. And there were those who took the opportunity to join in the fun, and create amusing hashtags like hashtag in Blomkvist's day. It was all a lot of nonsense, and nobody could have cared less than Blomkvist. Or so he persuaded himself. It certainly did not help his cause that he had not had a major story since the Zalachenko affair, and that Millennium really was in a crisis. The circulation was still okay, with 21,000 subscribers, but since advertising revenue was falling dramatically, and there was no longer additional income from their successful books, and since one of the shareholders, Harriet Fanger, was not willing to put up any more capital, the board of directors had, against Blomkvist's wishes, allowed the Norwegian Cerner newspaper empire to buy 30% of the shares. That was not as odd as it seemed, or not at first sight. Cerner published weekly magazines and evening papers, and owned a large online dating site, and two premium TV channels, as well as a football team in Norway's top division, and ought not to have anything to do with a publication like Millennium. But Cerner's representatives, especially the head of publications, Ove Levin, had assured them that the group needed a prestige product, and that everybody in the management team admired Millennium and wanted only for the magazine to go on exactly as before.
"We're not here to make money," Levin said. "We want to do something significant."
He immediately arranged for the magazine to receive a sizable injection of funds. At first, Senna did not interfere in the editorial work. It was business as usual, but with a slightly better budget. A new feeling of hope spread among the editorial team, sometimes even to Blomqvist, who felt that for once he would have time to devote himself to journalism instead of worrying about finances. But then, around the time the campaign against him got under way, he would never lose the suspicion that the Sauna group had taken advantage of the situation, the tone changed, and they started to apply pressure. Levin maintained that of course the magazine should continue with its in-depth investigations, its literary reporting, its social fervour. But surely it was not necessary for all the articles to be about financial irregularities, injustices, and political scandals. Writing about high society, about celebrities and premiers, could also produce brilliant journalism, so he said, and he spoke with passion about Vanity Fair and Esquire in America, about Gay Talese and his classic piece Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, and about Norman Mailer and Truman Capote and Tom Wolfe and heaven knows who else. Blomqvist did not actually have any objections to that, not at the time. 6 months earlier he had himself written a long piece about the paparazzi industry, and as long as he could find a serious angle, then he was content to profile just about any lightweight. In fact, he always said it isn't the subject that determines good journalism, it's the reporter's attitude. Now, what he objected to was what he sensed was there between the lines. That this was the beginning of a longer-term assault, and that, to the group, Millennium was just like any other magazine. A publication you can damn well shift around any which way you want until it becomes profitable. And colourless. So on Friday afternoon, when he heard that Levin had hired a consultant and commissioned several consumer surveys to present on Monday, Blomqvist had simply gone home. For a long time he had sat at his desk, or lain in bed composing various impassioned speeches about why Millennium had to remain true to its vision. There is rioting in the suburbs. An openly racist party sits in Riksdagen, the parliament. Intolerance is growing, fascism is on the rise, and there are homeless people and beggars everywhere. In many ways, Sweden has become a shameful nation. He came up with lots of fine and lofty words, and in his daydreams he enjoyed a series of fantastic triumphs, in which what he said was so relevant and compelling that the whole editorial team, and even the entire Sauna group, were roused from their delusions and decided to follow him as one. But when sobriety set in, he realized how little weight such words carry if nobody believes in them from a financial point of view. Money talks, bullshit walks. First and foremost, the magazine had to pay its way. Then they could go about changing the world. He began to wonder whether he could rustle up a good story. The prospect of a major revelation might boost the confidence of the editorial team and get them all to forget about Levin's surveys and forecasts. Blomqvist's big scoop about the Swedish government conspiracy that had protected Zalachenko turned him into a news magnet. Every day he received tips about irregularities and shady dealings. Most of it, to tell the truth, was rubbish. But just occasionally the most amazing story would emerge. A run-of-the-mill insurance matter or a trivial report of a missing person could be concealing something crucial. You never knew for sure. You had to be methodical and look through it all with an open mind. And so, on Saturday morning, he sat down with his laptop and his notebooks and picked his way through what he had. He kept going until 5 in the afternoon. He did come across the odd item which would probably have gotten him going 10 years ago, but which did not now stir any enthusiasm. It was a classic problem. He, of all people, knew that. After a few decades in the profession, most things feel pretty familiar, and even if something looks like a good story in intellectual terms, it still might not turn you on. So when yet another squall of freezing rain whipped across the rooftops, he stopped working and turned to Elizabeth George. It wasn't just escapism, he persuaded himself. Sometimes the best ideas occur to you while your mind is occupied with something completely different. Pieces of the puzzle can suddenly fall into place. But he failed to come up with anything more constructive than the thought that he ought to spend more time lying around like this, reading good books. When Monday morning came, and with it yet more foul weather, he had ploughed through 1½ George novels, plus 3 old copies of The New Yorker, which had been cluttering up his bedside table. So there he was, sitting on the living-room sofa, with his cappuccino, looking out at the storm. He had been feeling tired and listless, until he got to his feet with an abrupt start, as if he had suddenly decided to pull himself together and do something, and put on his boots and his winter coat, and went out. It was a parody of hell out there. Icy, heavy, wet squalls bit into his bones as he hurried down towards Hornsgarten, which lay before him looking unusually grey. The whole of Södermalm district seemed to have been drained of all colour. Not even one tiny bright autumn leaf flew through the air. With his head bent forward and his arms crossed over his chest, he continued past Maria Magdalena Kirche to Slussen, all the way until he turned right onto Jutgatsparken, and as usual he slipped in between the Monkey Boutique and the Indigo Pub, then went up to the magazine on the 4th floor, just above the offices of Greenpeace. He could already hear the buzz when he was in the stairwell. An unusual number of people were up there. Apart from the editorial team and the key freelancers, there were 3 people from Cerner, 2 consultants and Levin, who had dressed down for the occasion. He no longer looked like an executive, and had picked up some new expressions. Among others, a cheery, "Hi! Hi, Micka! How's things?"
"That depends on you,"
Blomqvist said, not actually meaning to sound unfriendly. But he could tell that it was taken as a declaration of war, and he nodded stiffly, walked in, and sat down on one of the chairs which had been set out to make a small auditorium in the office. Levin cleared his throat and looked nervously in Blomqvist's direction. The star reporter, who had seemed so combative in the doorway, now looked politely interested, and showed no sign of wanting to have a row. But this did nothing to set Levin's mind at ease. Once upon a time he and Blomqvist had both temped for Expressen. They mostly wrote quick news stories and a whole lot of rubbish. But afterwards, in the pub, they had dreamed about the big stories, and talked for hours of how they would never be satisfied with the conventional or the shallow, but instead would always dig deep. They were young and ambitious, and wanted it all at once. There were times when Levin missed that. Not the salary, or the working hours, or even the easy life in the bars and the women, but the dreams. He missed the power in them. He sometimes longed for that throbbing urge to change society and journalism, and to write so that the world would come to a standstill and the mighty powers bow down. Even a hotshot like himself wondered, where did the dreams go? Micka Blomqvist had made every single one of them come true, not just because he had been responsible for some of the big exposés of modern times, but also because he really wrote with that passion and power that they had fantasized about. Never once had he bowed to pressure from the establishment or compromised his ideals, whereas Levin himself... Well, really, he was the one with the big career, wasn't he? He was probably making 10 times as much as Blomqvist these days, and that gave him an enormous amount of pleasure. What use were Blomqvist's scoops when he couldn't even buy himself a country place nicer than that little shack on the island of Sandhamn? My God, what was that hut compared to a new house in Cannes? Nothing. Now, it was Levin who had chosen the right path. Instead of slogging it out in the daily press, he had taken a job as media analyst at Cerner, and developed a personal relationship with Håkan Cerner himself, and that had changed his life and made him rich. Today he was the most senior journalist responsible for a whole series of newspaper houses and channels, and he loved it. He loved the power, the money, and all that went with it. Yet he was not above admitting that even he sometimes dreamed about that other stuff. In small doses, of course, but still. He wanted to be regarded as a fine writer, just like Blomqvist, and that was probably why he had pushed so hard for the group to buy a stake in Millennium. A little bird had told him that the magazine was up against it, and that the editor-in-chief, Erika Berger, whom he had always secretly fancied, wanted to keep on her 2 latest recruits, Sophie Melker and Emil Granden. And she would not be able to do so unless they got some fresh capital. In short, Levin had seen an unexpected opportunity to buy into one of the most prestigious brands in Swedish media. But Cerner's management was not enthusiastic, to put it mildly. On the contrary, people were heard to mutter that Millennium was old-fashioned, and had a left-wing bias, and a tendency to end up in fights with important advertisers and business partners, and, if Levin had not argued his case so passionately, the plan would have come to nothing. But he had insisted. In a broader context, he argued, investing in Millennium represented a negligible amount, which might not yield vast profits, but could give them something much greater, namely credibility. Right now, after the cutbacks and bloodletting, Sandner's reputation wasn't exactly their prime asset. Taking a stake in Millennium would be a sign that the group did, after all, care about journalism and freedom of expression, even if Sandner's board was not conspicuously keen on either. This much they were able to understand, and Levin got his acquisition through, and for a long time it looked like a winning outcome for all parties. Sandner got good publicity, and Millennium kept its staff, and was able to concentrate on what it did best— carefully researched, well-written reportage, with Levin himself beaming like the sun and even taking part in a debate at the Writers' Club, where he said in his usual modest way, "I believe in virtuous enterprise. I have always fought for investigative journalism." But then he did not want to think about it. At first he was not bothered by the campaign against Blomqvist. Ever since his former colleague's meteoric rise in the reporting firmament, Levin had rejoiced secretly whenever Blomqvist was sneered at in the media. This time, though, his joy did not last. Sandner's young son, Torvald, spotted the commotion. Social media made a big thing of it, even though he was not a man who took any interest in what journalists had to say. He did like power and intrigue, and here he saw a chance to score some points, or simply to give the older generation on the board a good drubbing. Before long, Torvald had encouraged the CEO, who until quite recently had not concerned himself with such trivial matters, to declare that Millennium could not be given any special treatment, but would have to adapt to the new times like all of the other products in the group. Levin, who had just given Beria a solemn promise that he would not interfere in the editorial line, save perhaps as a friend and adviser, all of a sudden felt that his hands were tied. He was forced to play some intricate games behind the scenes. He did everything he could to get Beria, Marlin Eriksson, and Krista Malm at the magazine to buy into the new policy, which was never in fact clearly expressed, something that flares up in a panic rarely is, but which somehow entailed making Millennium younger and more commercial. Naturally, Levin kept repeating that there could be no question of compromising the magazine's soul and provocative attitude, even if he was not sure what he meant by that. He only knew that to keep the directors happy, he needed to get more glamour into the magazine and reduce the number of lengthy investigations into industry, since they were liable to irritate advertisers and make enemies for the board. But of course he did not tell Beria this. He wanted to avoid unnecessary conflict, and, standing there in front of the editorial team, he had taken the trouble to dress more casually than usual. He did not want to provoke anyone by wearing the shiny suits and ties which had become all the rage at the head office. Instead, he had opted for jeans and a white shirt, and a dark blue V-necked pullover which was not even cashmere. His long curly hair, which had always been his rebellious little gimmick, was tied in a ponytail, just like the edgiest journalists on TV. But most important of all, he kicked off in the humble tone he had been taught in his management courses. "Hello, everybody," he said. "What foul weather! I've said it many times before, but I'm happy to repeat it. We of Cerner are incredibly proud to be accompanying you on this journey, and for me personally it amounts to even more than that. It's the commitment to magazines like Millennium which makes my job meaningful. It reminds me why I went into this profession in the first place. Mika, do you remember how we used to sit in the opera bar and dream about everything we were going to achieve together? And we weren't exactly holding back on the booze, ha ha!" Blomqvist did not look as if he remembered. But Levin was not put off. "Don't worry, I'm not going to get all nostalgic," he said. "And there's no reason to do so. In those days, there was much more money in our industry. Just to cover some piddling little murder in the middle of nowhere, we would hire a helicopter and book an entire floor at the poshest hotel and order champagne for the after-party. You know, when I was about to go off on my first overseas trip, I asked Ulf Nielsen, foreign correspondent at the time, what the Deutschmark exchange rate was. 'I have no idea,' he said. 'I set my own exchange rate.' Ha! We used to pad our expenses. Do you remember, Mika? Maybe we were at our most creative back then. In any case, all we had to do was knock out some quick copy and we still managed to sell any number of issues. But a lot has changed since then. We all know that. We now face cutthroat competition, and it's not easy these days to make a profit in journalism, not even if you have Sweden's best editorial team, as you do. So I thought we should talk a little bit today about the challenges of the future. Not that I imagine for one moment that I can teach you anything. I'm just going to provide you with some context for discussion. We at Sanna have commissioned some surveys about your readership and the public perception of Millennium. Some of it may give you a bit of a fright. But instead of letting it get you down, you should see it as a challenge. And remember, there are some totally crazy changes happening out there.
Levin paused for a moment and wondered if the term totally crazy had been a mistake, if he had tried too hard to appear relaxed and youthful, and whether he had started off in too chatty and jocular a vein. As Harken Serner would say, it is impossible to overestimate how humourless underpaid journalists can be. But no, he decided, I'll fix this. I'll get them on my side. Blomqvist had stopped listening more or less at the point when Levin explained that they all needed to reflect on their digital maturity. So he did not hear them being told that the younger generation were not aware of Millennium, or Mikael Blomqvist. Unfortunately, that was precisely the moment at which he decided he had had enough, and went out to the coffee room. So he had no idea either that Aaron Ullmann, the Norwegian consultant, quite openly said, "Pathetic! Is he so scared that he's going to be forgotten?" In fact, nothing could have worried Blomqvist less at that moment. He was angry that Levin seemed to think consumer surveys might be their salvation. It was no bloody market analysis that had created the magazine. It was passion and fire. Millennium had gotten to where it was because they had all put their faith in it, and in what felt right and important, without trying to guess which way the wind was blowing. For a time he just stood there in the pantry, wondering how long it would take before Beria came to join him. The answer was about 2 minutes. He tried to calculate how angry she was by the sound of her heels, but when she was standing next to him, she only gave him a dejected smile. "What's going on?" she said.
"I just couldn't bear to listen."
"You do realize that people feel incredibly uncomfortable when you behave like that?"
"I do."
"And I assume you also understand that Serna can do nothing without our agreement. We still have control."
"Like hell we do. We're their hostages, Ricky.
Don't you get it?
If we don't do as they say, they'll withdraw their support and then we'll be sitting there with our asses hanging out," he said, loudly and angrily.
When Beria hushed him and shook her head, he added, sotto voce,
"I'm sorry. I'm being a brat. But I'm going home now. I need to think."
"You've started to work extremely short hours."
"Well, I reckon I'm owed a fair bit of overtime."
"I suppose you are. Would you like company this evening?"
"I don't know. I honestly don't know, Erica," he said.
And then he left the magazine offices and went out onto Jutgatsbaken. The storm and the freezing rain lashed against him, and he swore, and for a moment considered dashing into Pocket Shop to buy yet another English detective novel to escape into. Instead he turned onto St. Paulsgaten, and as he was passing the sushi restaurant on the right-hand side, his mobile rang. He was sure that it would be Beria, but it was Pernilla, his daughter, who had chosen the worst possible time to get in touch with a father who already felt bad about how little he did for her.
"Hello, my darling," he said.
"What's that noise?"
"It's the storm, I expect."
"Okay, okay, I'll be quick. I've been accepted into the writing course at Biskops Arno School."
"So, now you want to be a writer," he said,
in a tone which was too harsh and almost sarcastic, and that was unfair in every way. He should have simply congratulated her and wished her luck, but Pernilla had had so many difficult years hopping between one Christian sect and another, and from one course to another without finishing anything, that he felt exhausted by yet another change of direction.
"I don't think I detected a whoop of joy there."
"Sorry, Pernilla. I'm not myself today."
"When are you ever?"
"I'm just not sure writing is such a good idea, given how the profession is looking right now."
I only want you to find something that will really work for you.
I'm not going to write boring journalism like you.
Well, what are you going to write, then?
I'm going to write for real.
Okay, he said, without asking what she meant by that. Do you have enough money?
I'm working part-time at Wayne's Coffee.
Would you like to come to dinner tonight so we can talk about it?
Don't have time, Papa. It was just to let you know,
she said, and hung up. Even if he tried to see the positive side in her enthusiasm, it just made his mood worse. He took a short cut across Maria Toriot and Hornsgarten to reach his apartment on Bellmansgarten. It felt as if he had only just left. He got a strange sense that he no longer had a job, and that he was on the verge of entering a new existence where he had oceans of time instead of working his fingers to the bone. For a brief moment he considered tidying the place up. There were magazines and books and clothes everywhere, but instead he fetched 2 Pilsner Urquell from the fridge and sat down on the sofa in the living room to think everything through more soberly as one can with a bit of beer in one's body. What was he to do? He had no idea. And most worrying of all was that he was in no mood for a fight. On the contrary, he was strangely resigned, as if Millennium were slipping out of his sphere of interest. "Isn't it time to do something new?" he asked himself. And he thought of Kajsa Åkerstam, a quite charming person whom he would occasionally meet for a few drinks. Åkerstam was head of Swedish television's investigative task force program, and she had for years been trying to recruit him. It had never mattered what she had offered, or how solemnly she had guaranteed backing and total integrity. Millennium had been his home and his soul. But now, maybe he should take the chance. Perhaps a job on the investigative task force program would fire him up again. His mobile rang, and for a moment he was happy. Whether it was Beria or Pernilla, he promised himself he would be friendly and really listen. But no, it was a withheld number, and he answered guardedly.
"Is that Mikael Blomqvist?" said a young-sounding voice.
"Yes," he said.
"Do you have time to talk?"
"I might if you introduced yourself."
"My name is Linus Brando."
"Okay, Linus, how can I help?"
"I have a story for you."
"Tell me."
"I will, if you can drag yourself down to the Bishop's Arms across the street and meet me there."
Blomqvist was irritated. It wasn't just the bossy tone, it was the intrusion on his home turf.
"The phone will do just fine."
"It's not something which should be discussed on an open line."
"Why do I feel so tired talking to you, Linus?"
"Maybe you've had a bad day."
"I have had a bad day. You're right about that."
"There you go. Come down to the Bishop, and I'll buy you a beer and tell you something amazing."
Blomqvist wanted only to snap, "Stop telling me what to do." Yet without knowing why, or perhaps because he didn't have anything better to do than sit in his attic apartment and brood over his future, he said,
"I pay for my own beers. But okay, I'm coming."
"A wise decision."
"But, Linus..."
"Yes?"
"If you get long-winded and give me a load of wild conspiracy theories to the effect that Elvis is alive and you know who shot Olaf Palmer, then I'm going straight home."
"Fair enough," Brando said.
Chapter 3 November 20th Edwin Needham, Ed the Ned, as he was sometimes called, was not the most highly paid security technician in the United States, but he may have been the best. He grew up in South Boston, Dorchester, and his father had been a monumental good-for-nothing, a drunk who took on casual work in the harbour, but often disappeared on binges which not infrequently landed him in jail or in hospital. These benders were the family's best time, a sort of breathing space. When Ed's father could be bothered to be around, he would beat his mother black and blue. Sometimes she would spend hours or even whole days locked inside the toilet, crying and shaking. Nobody was very surprised when she died from internal bleeding at only 46. Or when Ed's older sister became a crack addict, still less when the remains of the family soon afterwards stood teetering on the brink of homelessness. Ed's childhood paved the way for a life of trouble, and during his teenage years he belonged to a gang that called themselves the Fuckers. They were the terror of Dorchester, and got mixed up in everything from muggings to robbing grocery stores. There was something brutal about Ed's appearance from an early age, and this was not improved by the fact that he never smiled and was missing two upper teeth. He was sturdy, tall, and fearless, and his face usually bore the traces of brawls with his father, or gang fights. Most of the teachers at his school were scared to death of him. All were convinced that he would end up in jail, or with a bullet in his head. But there were some adults who began to take an interest in him, no doubt because they discovered that there was more than aggression and violence in his intense blue eyes. Ed had an irrepressible thirst for knowledge, an energy which meant that he could devour a book with the same vigour with which he could trash the inside of a public bus. Often he was reluctant to go home at the end of the school day. He liked to stay on in what was known as the technology room, where there were a couple of computers. He would sit there for hours. A physics teacher, with a Swedish-sounding name of Larsen, noticed how good he was with machines, and after social services got involved he was awarded a scholarship and transferred to a school with more motivated students. He began to excel at his studies and was given more scholarships and distinctions, and eventually, something of a miracle in view of the odds against him, he went on to study electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. In his doctoral thesis, he explored some specific fears around new asymmetric cryptosystems like RSA, and then went on to senior positions at Microsoft and Cisco, before being recruited by the National Security Agency in Fort Meade, Maryland. He did not have the ideal CV for the job, even leaving aside his criminal behavior as a teenager. He had smoked a lot of grass at college and flirted with socialist or even anarchist ideals. He had also been arrested twice for assault, bar fights. He still had a volcanic temper, and everyone who knew him thought better of crossing him. But at the NSA, they recognized his other qualities, besides which it was the autumn of 2001, and the American security services were so desperate for computer technicians that they hired pretty much anybody. During the ensuing years, nobody questioned Needham's loyalty, or patriotism for that matter, and if anyone thought to do so, his advantages always outweighed his shortcomings. Needham was not just amazingly gifted. There was an obsessive streak to his character, a manic precision and a furious efficiency which boded well for a man in charge of building IT security at America's most highly classified agency. Nobody was damn well going to crack his system. It was a matter of personal pride for him. At Fort Meade, he quickly made himself indispensable to the point where people were constantly lining up to consult him. Not a few were terrified of him. He was often verbally abusive, and had even told the head of the NSA himself, the legendary Admiral Charles O'Connor, to go to hell.
"Use your own busy fucking head for things you might just be able to understand," Needham had roared when the Admiral had attempted to comment on his work.
But O'Connor and everyone else let it happen. They knew that Needham screamed and yelled for the right reasons, because colleagues had been careless about security regulations, or because they were talking about things beyond their understanding. Not once did he interfere in the rest of the agency's work, even though his level of clearance gave him access to pretty much everything, and even though in recent years the agency had found itself at the center of a heated storm of opinion, advocates of both the right and the left, seeing the NSA as the devil incarnate, Orwell's big brother. As far as Needham was concerned, the organization could do whatever the hell it wanted, so long as his security systems remained rigorous and intact. And since he did not yet have a family, he more or less lived at the office. Apart from the occasional drinking session, during which he sometimes turned alarmingly sentimental about his past, there was no suggestion that he had ever told outsiders what he was working on. In that other world, he remained as silent as the grave, and if ever questioned about his profession, he stuck to a well-rehearsed cover story. It was not by chance, nor was it the result of intrigue or manipulation, that he had risen through the ranks and become the NSA's most senior security chief. Needham and his team had tightened internal surveillance so that no new whistleblowers can pop up and punch us in the nose, and during countless sleepless nights created something which he alternately called an unbreakable wall, or a ferocious little bloodhound. "No fucker can get in, and no fucker can dig around without permission," he said. And he was enormously proud of that. He had been proud, that is, until that disastrous morning in November. The day had begun beautiful and clear. Needham, who had put on a belly over the years, came waddling over from the coffee machine in his characteristic way. Because of his seniority, he completely ignored dress codes. He was wearing jeans and a red check lumberjack shirt, not quite buttoned at the waist, and he sighed as he settled down at his computer. He was not feeling great. His back and right knee hurt, and he cursed the fact that his long-time colleague Alona Casalis had managed to persuade him to come out for a run the night before. Sheer sadism on her part. Luckily, there was nothing super urgent to deal with. He only had to send an internal memo with some new procedures for those in charge of COST, a program for cooperation with the large IT companies. He had even changed the code names. But he did not get far. He was just beginning to write, in his usual turgid prose. To keep you all on your toes as good paranoid cyber agents, so that no one will be tempted to fall back into idiotic habits, I would just like to point out, when he was interrupted by one of his alerts. He was not particularly worried. His warning systems were so sensitive that they reacted to the slightest divergence in the information flow. It was going to be an anomaly, a notification perhaps that someone was trying to exceed the limits of their authorization, or some minor interference. As it turned out, he never had time to investigate. In the next moment, something so uncanny happened that for several seconds he refused to believe it. He just sat there, staring at the screen. Yet he knew exactly what was going on. A rat had been put on the intranet, NSAnet. Anywhere else he would have thought, "Those fuckers, I'll crush them." But in here, the most tightly closed and controlled place of all, which he and his team had gone over with a fine-toothed comb a million times just this last year to detect every minuscule little vulnerability, here, no, no, it was impossible. It could not be happening. Without realizing it, he had closed his eyes, as if hoping that it would all vanish so long as he wasn't watching. But when he looked at the screen again, the sentence he had begun was being completed. His, "I would just like to point out," was continuing on its own with the words, "that you should stop with all the illegal activity. Actually, it's pretty straightforward. Those who spy on the people end up themselves being spied on by the people. There's a fundamental democratic logic to it."
"Jesus! Jesus!" he muttered,
which was at least a sign that he was beginning to recover some of his composure. But then the text went on. "Chill out, Ed. Why don't you stick around for a ride? I've got root." At which point he gave a loud cry. The word root brought down his whole world. For about a minute, as the computer raced through the most confidential parts of the system at lightning speed, he genuinely believed that he was going to have a heart attack. He was only vaguely aware that people were beginning to gather around his desk. There was not much of a crowd down at the Bishop's Arms. It was only early in the afternoon, and the weather was not encouraging people to venture out, not even to the local pub. Blomqvist was nevertheless met by shouts and laughter, and by a hoarse voice bawling,
"Kalle Blomqvist!"
It came from a man with a puffy red face, a halo of frizzy hair, and a fussy moustache, whom Blomqvist had seen many times in the area. He thought his name was Arne. Arne would turn up at the pub as regularly as clockwork at 2 every afternoon, but today he had clearly come earlier than that and settled down at a table to the left of the bar with 3 drinking companions.
"Mikael Blomqvist,"
Blomqvist corrected him with a smile. Arne and his friends laughed as if Blomqvist's actual name was the greatest joke ever.
"Got any good scoops?" Arne said.
"I'm thinking about blowing wide open the whole murky scene at the Bishop's Arms."
"You reckon Sweden's ready for a story like that?"
"No, probably not."
In truth, Blomqvist quite liked this crowd, not that he ever talked to them more than in throwaway lines and banter, but these men were a part of the local scene which made him feel at home in the area, and he was not in the least bit offended when one of them shot out,
"I've heard that you're washed up."
Far from upsetting him, it brought the whole campaign against him down to the low, almost farcical level where it belonged.
"I've been washed up for the last 15 years. Hello to you, Brother Bottle. "All good things must pass," he said, quoting the poet Fröding, and looking around for someone who might have had the gall to order a tired journalist down to the pub. Since he saw no one apart from Arne and his gang, he went up to Amir at the bar. Amir was big and fat and jolly, a hard-working father of four who had been running the pub for some years. He and Blomqvist had become good friends. Not because Blomqvist was an especially regular customer, but because they had helped each other out in completely different ways. Once or twice, when Blomqvist had not had the time to get to the state liquor store and was expecting female company, Amir had supplied him with a couple of bottles of red wine, and Blomqvist in turn had helped a friend of Amir's, who had no papers, to write letters to the authorities.
"To what do we owe this honour?"
Amir said.
"I'm meeting someone."
"Anyone exciting?"
"I don't think so."
"How's Sarah?" Sarah was Amir's wife and had just had a hip operation.
"Complaining and taking painkillers?"
"Sounds like hard work. Give her my best."
"Will do,"
Amir said, and they chatted about this and that. But Linus Brandel did not show up, and Blomqvist thought it was probably a practical joke. On the other hand, there were worse tricks to fall victim to than to be lured down to your local pub, so he stayed for 15 minutes discussing a number of financial and health-related concerns before he turned and walked towards the door. And that is when Brandel appeared. Nobody understood how Gabriella Grana had ended up at SEPO, Swedish Security Police, least of all she herself. She had been the sort of girl for whom everybody had predicted a glittering future. Her old girlfriends, from the classy suburb of Djursholm, worried that she was 33 and neither famous, nor wealthy, nor married, either to a rich man or to any man at all, for that matter. "What's happened to you, Gabriella? Are you going to be a policeman all your life?" Most of the time she could not be bothered to argue, or point out that she was not a police officer, but had been head-hunted for the position of analyst, and that these days she was writing far more challenging texts than she ever had at the Foreign Ministry, or during her summers as a leader writer for Svenska Dagbladet. Apart from which, she was not allowed to talk about most of it in any case, so she might as well keep quiet and simply come to terms with the fact that working for the Swedish Security Police was considered to be about as low as you can go, both by her status-obsessed friends, and even more so by her intellectual pals. In their eyes, SEPO was a bunch of clumsy, right-leaning idiots who went after Kurds and Arabs for what were fundamentally racist reasons, and who had no qualms about committing serious crimes or infringements of civil rights in order to protect former senior Soviet spies. And, indeed, sometimes she was on their side. There was incompetence in the organization, values that were unsound, and the Zalichenko affair remained a major blot. But that was not the whole truth. Stimulating and important work was being done as well, especially now after the shakeout, and sometimes she had the impression that it was at SEPO, not in any editorial or lecture hall, that people best understood the upheavals that were taking place across the world. But she still often asked herself, "How did I end up here? And why have I stayed?" Presumably some of it came down to flattery. No less a person than Helena Kraft, the newly appointed chief of SEPO at the time, had contacted her and said that, after all the disasters and bad press, they had to rethink their approach to recruitment. "We need to bring on board the real talents from the universities, and quite honestly, Gabriella, there's no better person than you." That was all it had taken. Grana was hired as an analyst in counter-espionage and later in the Industry Protection Group. Even though, as a young woman, attractive in a slightly proper sort of way, she got called a daddy's girl and snotty upper-class bitch, she was a star recruit, quick and receptive and able to think outside the box. And she could speak Russian. She had learned it alongside her studies at the Stockholm School of Economics, where, needless to say, she had been a model student, but never that keen. She dreamed of something bigger than a life in business. So after her graduation she applied for a job at the Foreign Ministry and was accepted. But she did not find that especially stimulating either. The diplomats were too stiff and neatly combed. It was then that Helena Kraft had gotten in touch. Grana had been at SEPO for 5 years now, and had gradually been accepted for the talent that she was, even if it was not always easy. It had been a trying day. Not just because of the ghastly weather.
The head of the division, Ragnar Olafsson, had appeared in her office looking surly and humourless, and told her that she should damn well not be flirting when she was out on an assignment. Flirting?
Flowers have been delivered.